even in COVID, right? You have all of these internet people who've made so much money, even the influencers, people on TikTok, people who created, you know, merch shops or whatever the last few years, are making $1 million, $2 million a year doing nothing.
Welcome to the podcast, where we introduce you to incredible humans who share their journeys with the mission to inspire you to harness your own inner tenacity to drive your life and career forward. And now, your host, Adam Posner.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. We're bringing the best and the brightest from the world of business, marketing, and personal growth to help you harness your inner tenacity and drive your career forward. Folks, my guest today in the podcast is Kelly Ann Winget. Kelly Ann is an accomplished alternative investment expert and founder of Alternative Wealth Partners, AWP, the first private equity firm founded and led by millennial, openly LGBTQ women. Kelly has raised close to $1 billion in capital. That's amazing. For startups, energy companies, manufacturing ventures, real estate, and other key markets, including initiatives in opportunity zone funds, I'm very curious about that, and aligning social impact investing through creative tax strategies. She's also the author, let's get the music back on because there's more cool stuff here, also the author of Pitch the Bitch, Grab Your Financial Future by the Bags, and a sought-after keynote speaker and panelist. Kelly, when she's not working, enjoys traveling with her partner, spending time with her kids and family, cuddling with her two dogs, and we have a lot to unpack. Let's get to it. Kelly, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And Kelly's joining us from the great state of Texas.
Yes.
In Dallas. Welcome, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Kelly has already had a busy day. She's already filled me in. 5:30 a.m. start. Breakfast meetings, family meetings, getting all the kids ready for school and all that good stuff. But let's hit the rewind button. And I want to introduce you, aside from the biography, to the crowd and my audience here. What I like to do is hit the rewind button. Obviously, you're in the financial world. Mm-hmm. Was that always like, were you always like a financially, fiscally minded child? Like, was that always there? Were you always like saving? And like, when did you first become like self-aware of what money was?
Well, I had two parents who were in financial services. You know, it's really exciting to have CPAs as parents. Mm. so we were early in our journey on money. You know, it was always an open topic at the dinner table. Mm. You know, our allowances started early. We were responsible for a lot of things around the house. You know, our job in school was taken seriously and attached to a dollar amount of, you know, what was expected of us. But I really wanted a lot of independence. And so when I turned 15, I wanted a really expensive pair of jeans. My parents were like, absolutely not. Remember, this is like 2004. So Buckle was really popular, like the bedazzled, you know, jeans that were $300. And so I said, fine, I'll go get my own job. And so I went and got a job at a car wash as a cashier and quickly learned the business and started in sales and started outselling the service advisors outside from the cash register. And so I was a teenager making almost six figures in sales.
Boom.
So I was like, I like money.
I like money. I like what it could do for me. I want to talk. It's interesting. Both parents are CPAs, right? And I can only imagine how fascinating the dinner table chat was on that. But when you think about like where you are now, and we'll get there in a second. But like you look back and like, geez, those early lessons, what I learned from mom and dad, like what were some of those key learnings? You're like, shit, like those are core of my foundation is like as far as like my fundamentals of being a financial advisor and in this world.
I think it was just how to look at money in a different way as opposed to just like paying bills. I think that, you know, the difference between what my parents did, my father worked for PricewaterhouseCoopers, so like a large institution, and my mother worked for privately owned businesses. So their experiences as far as like what kind of projects they were working on and how they viewed money was very different.
It's different.
But not for the household necessarily. But we were always encouraged to kind of take ownership of what money meant to us and how we were to use it. You know, we weren't told you have to save this, you have to spend this, you have to, you know, do this. It was like, here's your money. And if you have goals like these, this is how you obtain those things. So, you know, we're 10 years old and getting our first bank accounts, you know, everything that we wanted, whether it was a candy bar at the grocery store or a toy at the store, whatever, we had to write a physical check to our parents for that thing, right? So we're like writing 50-cent checks for a candy bar. And so that we could actually have the experience of like paying for things and what that meant when the money came out of the account, like, and watching that.
So important.
Yeah, so it was just a part of everyday life, was to understand money moving in and out of things for us.
I love that. And let's talk about that now. We're both parents and we have children that are in the similar age. And it's always interesting of how to teach kids money, because, you know, I'm sure like your kids, my kids get money for birthday gifts and other holidays and everything. And my daughter just stuffs it, all this cash somewhere. I'm not going to say it online, you know, where she keeps it. And my son too puts it in his piggy bank, but he's only five. And my almost 12-year-old daughter really trying to teach her the concept of money. And for example, she'll want to buy something on Amazon instead of me just buying it. And I'm like, okay, you want that? That's $18. I will pay for it. Go to your room right now and get me $18 and give it to me. They have to understand the concept of things cost money and how to save it. And we're teaching how to save up. Talk to us a little bit about how you're infusing some of your personal and professional financial prowess on your children. Some lessons for parents out there. Some best practices, Kelly.
Yeah, that's a really hard thing. And even though like I'm a professional in this space, right? But I do a very specific thing. So some of the stuff that I do is kind of ridiculous, right? Like I'm sending wires for $100,000 or $1 million or something somewhere. And those are the kind of things that the kids are hearing at home. It's like, oh, I'm doing that, the other thing. Or we bought a company or we bought a property or whatever. And so, you know, trying to get them to understand that that's not like people's real experience with money, like that's a very separate thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that because everything's digital, right, we're not saving cash the same way that we were when we were
putting
kids.
In the mattress,
right, where you go and babysit and someone gives you a $20 bill. Yeah. You know, you go mow a lawn, you get
it's
10 bucks.
It's Venmo'd, it's all electronic. Yeah. It's all shift moving it around,
right? And so like even though we have bank accounts set up for the kids, like they're not logging into their bank account and seeing that stuff. So they go to the store and they're like, oh, I want this thing. And we're like, you don't have the money to do that, you know? And then they want to go into debt or borrow against like future things. And we're trying to explain debt to them. And, you know, that was a hard lesson for our 10-year-old, because he wanted a Zelda game, but it's like downloaded on the Switch. And we're like, that's $80. You know, you have $60. And so you're going to go into debt for this thing. He's like, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do all these extra chores. And so it took him a month and a half to like get the money back. And he was like, that was terrible. And I was like, yeah, how many times did you play Zelda? And he's like, once. I was like, great. So was that worth that?
Now you're teaching him ROI.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely like a live by experience thing. And thankfully it's in a controlled environment for now. But I think it's going to be really hard to teach this next generation like things about money, because it really is just made up. You don't see it, you don't touch it.
I really haven't thought about that. And so do you think, in your professional opinion, us as parents should be focusing more on new ways to work within this digital financial economy, or mix it up with cold hard cash so they could feel it and actually feel what it's like to pay for something with cash and have it and then not have it?
Yeah, I think it has to be a blend, because ultimately I don't think we're going to have the ability to do a tangible cash transaction. And so we have to figure out how to do it digitally with the things that they find valuable, right? $5 on Roblox or whatever it is equivalent to like an hour's worth of work as a minimum wage employee. You know, like, is this worth working a full hour on something, less taxes, to pay for $5 on Roblox, which you spend in 30 seconds, right?
Gone.
And so that's something you like, we have to figure out, and it's hard. Unfortunately, it's a learning process for both parties.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. And anybody in the audience listening, if you have any tips, feel free to email me. I'll put it up in the comments when we get the show posted. So, Kelly, let's talk a little bit about your journey into the finance. Like, did you know from a kid, like, this is what I was going to get into? One way or another, I was going to work with money. I was going to work with people. I was going to work in the financial space. Talk to us a little bit about your journey through school and how we got to where we are today.
Sure. So no, I didn't think that I was ever going to be, you know, in the financial space.
Would you want to be when you grew up?
The mayor. And
whoa, that's the first time I've the mayor.
And I was the mayor of Enterprise City in fifth grade, which is like a fake town. And I don't think they do this in school anymore, but a fake town, you were either assigned a job or you were elected into a job. Or
that's
like
so cool.
And so I was the mayor of Enterprise City, and that I was like, I just really like leading people and like helping, you know, structure something. And but that's not what I went to school for. It's not what I ultimately did or anything. I just really liked learning about a lot of different things. And so, you know, I had this experience in high school. I had a lot of jobs in high school. I just really liked making money because I spent a lot of money. I liked
going on out what? Jeans, bedazzled jeans.
Just going out and clothes and my car and, you know, being a teenager and with no real responsibilities. But, you know, when I graduated and went out, like I moved out, I had a moving truck the day I graduated high school and moved out on my own.
Love
and,
it.
For no reason, just being a brat, I think. And to be honest, and I just wanted my own life. And I worked for a healthcare company. I worked for a radiology firm for a few years, took skills I learned there and took a job with a demolition company. And so I worked in construction, but on the operation, like business side. And I learned a lot of really useful skills there from an operational standpoint and actually building databases and reporting tools. And so I took those skills from construction into oil and gas. And now I'm five generations in oil and gas, so I was going to find my way there one way or another. But I went to work for an oil and gas company. This was like kind of nearing the height of the market back when oil prices went up to $130 a barrel. I threw up a bunch of red flags and said, you know, this strategy isn't going to work. We're overpaying for assets. You know, this is not normal. They agreed to disagree because they're not going to listen to a 20-something-year-old girl.
Well, let's pause on that for a second there. Let's pause on this one for a second here. Because of your mindset and the way your brain operates, you saw indicators that were red flags.
Mm-hmm.
And you brought it to the attention of management.
Mm-hmm.
And why and how did they shoot you down?
I think that they didn't want to be told what to do. I mean, they were older.
Right, stuck in their ways.
Decades in the industry. You know, this is our moonshot in oil.
Hmm.
You know, it was just this big boom, right? And they were getting assets. They started out getting assets very cheap. And then as prices started to go up, they were overpaying because it was got really competitive to start acquiring those types of property down in South Texas, which means the investors were overpaying. And it just was kind of like a disaster waiting to happen that eventually did. And at that time, I was 22, 23, and they're not going to. They hired me to do reporting. That was it. Not, you know, I wasn't there to like.
So short-sighted.
Yeah. And so I said, best of luck to you. And I took an opportunity to move out to Southern California. And I worked out there helping companies, you know, raise capital, develop stories behind their brands and work with high net worth and family offices to raise capital. Eventually, I kind of shifted more into the investor education piece and working more on the investor side of like, how do you find and do due diligence on private opportunities in the alternative space? And then ultimately led to a family office that was my kind of aha moment of maybe I should be doing this on my own.
Yeah, let's pause there for a second there. I have in my notes here, because this is not my world. In fact, if you saw my financials, you would throw up all of your stuff. It's terrible. As a small business owner, it's tough these days. It's tough.
Yes.
It's tough. But I want to talk about shifting from traditional financial barriers to more an inclusive approach to investing. What does that mean in layman's terms?
So the private space has been pretty gatekept by ultra high net worth, family office, the institutional space. Like your big families, your Rockefellers, your Fords, those people, like they live in a completely different world than the rest of everyone. But the type of investing that they're doing is accessible to anyone that has $1 million net worth or makes over 200 grand, right? And now in today, in like today's space, I mean, there's 25 million millionaires in the United States. There's a lot of millionaires here.
Yeah, it's not what it used to be. I mean, the barrier, people are more entrepreneurial, money's cheaper, smart investments, the digital age, everyone. I mean, just look at OnlyFans, right? I'm saying like the ability to make money on your own as an entrepreneur has never been easier.
Yes. And I think that, you know, traditional finance, your financial advisors, your RIAs, things like that are so stuck in, okay, our target client is a small business owner that's been running his business for 25 years. They're 60 years old. They're either in retirement, wanting to retire, or wanting to sell, right, their business. They've made 250 a year. They're worth, you know, 3 to 5 million, maybe 10 mm-hmm. million. Like that's who they're targeting. But the reality is that through even in COVID, right, you have all of these internet people who've made so much money, even the influencers, people on TikTok, mm-hmm. people who created, you know, merch shops or whatever the last few years are making $1 million, $2 million a year doing nothing, right? And no one's helping them and can understand like the fact that windfall income like that doesn't last forever. And if you don't have the right team around you or the right plan, you're not going to know what to do when that runs out.
So how do you make these investment vehicles work hard for you, right? Is it still the traditional, you know, sock them away, you know, the 401ks, the whole term life? Or do we start thinking about things a little bit outside of the box? You know, as you're younger, you have an opportunity to take higher risk, higher reward versus your age versus risk factor. What's kind of your approach on that if you're consulting?
Well, like there's a blend, right? But I don't think that the 60-40 portfolio makes sense anymore. The market has experienced significant growth, right? And I think that there's probably still room to grow. But you have to think about the fact that a lot of these private companies aren't going public. And it's not because there's no one on the public side taking them that way. It's just that they don't want to, you know, and private equity has gotten so large that they don't really have to take these companies public to make money. And so the opportunity for Main Street to have access to those opportunities is going away. And it's becoming harder and harder to access that. So, you know, there is some self-responsibility there. That's why I wrote the book, you know, like you have to start caring about where your money goes besides, you know, what gets taken out of your check and invested on your behalf without you knowing.
What's your mindset on... You know, credit cards are the devil. And, you know, I've definitely gotten into trouble with them. And for me, I look at them sometimes as when things are tough, I rely on them as a, I'm not going to say cheap because that's not the right word with certain interest rates, but it's a bit of a safety net and going back and forth in it. What are your general thoughts on the best way to use credit cards?
And I think you can use credit cards however you need to use them. I think what people don't really talk about is the fact that like, if I have to put a tank of gas on a credit card, and even though I'm going to ultimately pay 22% on that tank of gas, like that $60 got me to work for 2 weeks and I made, you know, $2,500 or whatever, you know, $1,000. Mm-hmm. That 22% interest doesn't really matter because I needed to do that. And if I didn't do that, it would actually be more expensive than just to pay that. And, If you're responsible about it, there's a lot of benefit you can get from credit cards, right? If you use them the right way. I only pay with credit cards for things.
If you can pay them off and you play the points game, you're reaping. But then the credit card companies are not counting on you, which is a minority percentage. They're carrying on folks like me that carry debt, you know, balances.
And for me, like I can keep balances on credit cards anyways, because for me, I'm earning so much on my cash that I don't care how long that sits. The amount of interest that I take out on credit is not that much, right? Paying $100 in interest when I have got the same amount of cash working, making $1,000, like it doesn't matter to me. And I think that if people took the time to kind of understand how to use money in that way, people can be more effective with their credit cards.
I think you just hit the nail on the head. It's like, how do you stay liquid? I know as a small business owner, it's about cash flow. And especially during times when I have payroll and I have other folks that I like, it's like, all right, I need to keep the cash flow here versus paying off the debt, and changing your mindset on that. Where's your money going to work harder for you, and how do you need it? And I think as a business owner, cash flow, that was my aha moment, Kelly. And I want to talk about yours in a second. As a small business owner, is understanding the concept of cash flow and really knowing like the balance of debt versus cash flow. But what was your aha moment? And because you mentioned it before, mm-hmm. What was that aha moment when you're like, I'm going to go do this on my own?
I was in a room with people and realized that I was the smartest person in the room, and that should be terrifying.
Yes.
You should never be in spaces like that. And if you are, you need to move quickly out of them. It doesn't necessarily make those people bad people to be around. It's just it will make you stuck. And there were things that were going on in that space that I didn't believe in, I didn't support. And having worked with like Main Street investors for as long as I have, I just didn't think that that was the type of service that they deserved, and wanted to create a family office concept for individuals. We're not financial advisors. We're not an RIA. We build creative structured funds on behalf of investors that want a piece of their portfolio held with us. I don't really care what people do with their money, but I do think that people should invest a little bit with us and risk a little bit. And we help people find the right professionals to help them with the rest of their life.
Hey, everybody. I want to talk about a product and platform that I absolutely love and our latest sponsor, Interseller, the prospecting and outreach platform of choice for recruiters and sellers. Whether you're doubling down on business development or recruiting talent, Interseller does all the heavy lifting of finding contact data, automating the email and follow-up process, and syncs all that rich data into 20-plus CRM and ATS platforms. Reach out now and get going on a 2-week free trial, and let them know you heard about it from Adam on the podcast today. Check out the link on the website. Appreciate it. I dig it. Let's talk about your journey to becoming the first millennial LGBTQ woman to establish your own fund and firm. What were the challenges there? Were there more barriers, or were you leveraging this angle? Like, talk to us a little bit about that journey, the challenges and the upside.
Well, I'm in very male dominated spaces. I mean, we're talking about like oil and gas and like defense and, you know, private equity.
And in Texas, right? Yeah. Texas. I gotcha.
I think it helps that I look like a lot of these guys.
Who the hell are you? Right?
Yeah.
A lot of that.
Okay, sweetheart.
All right.
Yes. I look like their granddaughter. So I wasn't met with hostility. It was more of like a polite, condescending something. And so I don't have the same problems like raising capital and managing investors as a lot of like my other female colleagues in venture. But definitely in the private equity space, I am the only woman around in most cases.
How do you use that to your advantage?
I think that it's refreshing sometimes to like see something different in a room. And I think that's even for the men that are there. They're like, oh my God, you know, thank God there's someone else here. I think that they have a hard time like pretending to like hoorah with each other, and want a different, you know, voice in the room. I get a lot of support from the men in the space because they are creative. That's why they're in private equity. And I have a, you know, different opinion than them, and they get to kind of debate and strategize.
Healthy in a debate. Way
that, yeah. That they don't get to do with their, you know, concurring partners that just say like, I agree.
Interesting. So I'm curious too. I mean, is, are you focusing from a client perspective on this niche audience of LGBT specifically? Are you open? Like, are you finding that as an opportunity for you to attract more business? I mean, it's marketing. It's who you are. It's who you represent. It's what you believe in. How are you navigating those waters?
I think I just make this stuff more accessible because I look like someone else, right?
I like that. Yeah.
And am someone else. So somebody who identifies as queer or is a woman, or is maybe BIPOC, like they see me and my team, and they're like, oh, there's someone there that looks like me, or someone who can understand that, like, I'm never going to have kids, but I'm going to be married to my partner, and yada yada. Right. So, like, then they're more comfortable, like, having
it's relatable.
Yeah, I'm relatable. And I think I lean into that more than, like, I'm only focused on queer women, because I'm not. Most of my limited partners, investors in my funds are women or Black women, really. And that's just because that's what I open my space up to.
That's tremendous. How can folks not in that community be better allies?
Just listen better, I think, is the biggest thing. You know, people do have their own lived experiences, and you're never going to be able to understand 100% of what they've been through or where they're going. But listening to the needs and the struggles that the investors have is really important. You know, people invest for all different types of reasons, and it's across the board. One individual wants to leave a legacy for their children, and the other just wants to be able to buy a boat and, like, live their best life. So, you know, and that's something you just have to listen
to. I love how you're positioning that. Kelly, what I'm going to spin it different. What's keeping you up at night these days?
I think that there's a lot of really terrible things happening in the world.
Oy.
And I think that people let that get in the way of helping each other and being effective on how to, like, move away from a world where that's normal. And, you know, I'm invested in commodities and stuff and, you know, things that are pretty controversial. And, you know, I have to open up people's minds of, like, well, how could you possibly be invested in that? I'm like, if I'm not invested in it, then a bad person is invested in it, you know? And I'm trying to change the narrative around these things and control who has access. Because if I can change who has access, then I can, you know, make things a little bit better in different parts of the world.
That is a clip right there. I love it. I'm like, mental note, clock at 26:02. We're going to make a clip of that. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about your book, Pitch the Bitch, Grab Your Financial Future by the Bags, which is helping women, marginalized communities, and allies understand investment, really preaching. But I want to talk about the term, don't pitch the bitch. And it was, right, boiler room. It's kind of a derogatory expression. Talk to us about where the origin and genesis of the title and how you're spinning it.
Yes. So in the movie, it's like, you know, this new stockbroker new to Wall Street, and he's getting trained by the old guy. And he's like, rule number one is that you don't pitch the bitch. If you get on the phone with the woman, you hang up, hang up. They're going to call you when the stock's up. They're going to call you when the stock's down. It's just a waste of your time. And, you know, this is in a movie, but I've, like, heard this exact phrase in so real life.
Yeah. Came from somewhere.
And different
misogyny,
versions.
Misogyny, it's just horrible.
Yeah. Different versions of that. Like, they have their name sounds too Black. Their name sounds too foreign.
Too ethnic.
You know, like,
yeah.
There's all these different things that are going on that is keeping, you know, the majority away from opportunity, and that was really bothersome to me. And so when I was coming up with the concept of the book and, like, writing through these things, I was like, I really want to focus on calling out the messaging that's happening in pop culture. I mean, I bring it all the way back to, like, biblical stories of, like, where this kind of, like, mindset, like, little voice is being created for women and other people. And, you know, the book walks through each kind of type of this messaging and how to, like, break that down so that, like, if you're hearing this voice or reading this type of messaging, it does not apply, right? And how to break through kind of that mental block of, like, I don't know what I'm doing. Because the book doesn't tell you what to invest in. And it doesn't tell you how to invest. It just says, here's the information you should know that's been gatekept from you and where to start so that you can start thinking about finances and your wealth journey as your own thing. Because the only person who cares about your money is you. And you just have to take responsibility for that. You cannot be passive.
You cannot be passive with your money.
Right. And so the book is focused on getting you out of that mindset of, like, somebody else is doing it for me. because that's the biggest problem, especially for women.
Oh, it's tremendous. Kelly, who's this book for?
Everyone, really. Because there's even
well, people if it's for everyone, it's for no one. And that's an expression I hear all the time. But who should be reading this book?
I think anyone that is feeling like maybe they're missing something, or not involved in, like, you know, I'm making money, but I don't seem to be where I think I should be.
Hmm.
And what am I missing? Right. Because a lot of people are making millions of dollars or even hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they're like, I'm worried about my retirement, or I'm worried about if I lose my job, and they shouldn't be. And they can, there's steps they can take that doesn't involve like hiring a bunch of people or like spending tens of thousands of dollars on a financial coach that doesn't actually know how to do anything.
The book's $19 book's a lot better investment. What did you learn about yourself during the process of writing this book? I love to ask authors. And how long did it take?
It took about 8 months. Because there was a lot of research involved, because, like, I think the biggest problem is that people don't know where to go for information that's unbiased, right? So building in the information in the book where it wasn't like, you should buy this product or use this service, which I think a lot of the financial literacy that, like, books that are out there are focused on, like, buy this thing. And I just wanted to give, like, really unbiased surface level financial education in a fun way. Like, the books, I have a sense of humor, so the book's pretty funny. But if you don't like vulgar language, it's probably not for you, because I do tell you that, like, you need to get your shit together.
Get your shit together.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. I love everything that you talk about. I love that you have fully, you know who you are. And you leverage that to your advantage, and you try to bring out the best of others in so many ways. So, Kelly, let's bring it home here. What is the single greatest piece of advice that you've ever received that you take action on daily? It could be a mantra, something you wake up, first thing in your mind, first thing that you say to get the day moving. When you woke up at 5:30 this morning and you have a whole agenda, you got to talk to this dude, Adam, in New York, and you just got to get your shit together. What do you say to yourself?
I think there's two things. One that is more like an action thing that I implement a lot is that you need to fail fast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, make smart but quick decisions, because you can really shoot yourself in the foot if you waste time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's better to just kind of fail and fix than it is to, like, sit and wait for the perfect answer. And then the other piece is purpose. And this is something that I've, like, kind of lived with my whole life. And, you know, my mom has a lot to do with this. And she's like, you have to always have purpose behind what you're doing, or, you know, none of it's really worth it. And so holding on to the purpose and long-term purpose, not just, you know, a daily purpose, but, like, why are you actually doing this? And so that's what gets me up and excited every morning, and why, you know, 5:30 in the morning doesn't bother me, because I know that my purpose and why I'm doing this is really important. So
I love it. And Kelly, last but not least, you look back on your life, your career, and there were those hard times like everybody else, those challenges, those obstacles you face because who you are and what you look like on the outside, and how you fought back with tenacity and you dug down deep. And you found that fire within you. And on the flip side right here, you sit with gratitude and just happy for this life, this family that you built. You're empowering so many people to be their best financial selves. What is your compass? What is your beacon? Kellyanne Winget, what is your North Star in life?
I think that I believe in the good in the world. I think that's what drives me. Is that I believe honestly that the world is a good place, and that if you're doing the right thing for the right reasons, that nothing can go wrong.
That is tremendous, Kelly. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. To learn more about Kelly, and there's links to her book as well, go to Kellyanne Winget. That's WINGET.com. I'm going to link it up in the comments there. Where else could folks find you? Where could they connect? Where could they learn more?
I'm very active on LinkedIn. It is the only social media that I actually run myself. So if you want to have direct, you know, insight to what I'm doing, catch me there. It's Kellyanne Winget on LinkedIn. And if you want to learn more about Alternative Wealth Partners, it's alternativewealthpartners.com.
Check it out. That'll be linked up in the comments. And when this show airs, you will see these clips on LinkedIn. Kelly will be tagged on LinkedIn. Pretty sure we're connected on LinkedIn. I live on LinkedIn. Kelly, I want to thank you so much for joining me. Hang out for 1 second here as I sign off. And everyone out there, if this show resonated with you, sharing means caring. Please spread the word. You know to find out more at thepodcast.com. Follow us on all the social media channels. Thank you for joining us. Remember, be good to yourself, be better to others, and catch us next week for another great episode of the podcast. Take care, everybody.
Wisdom is forever, but for us, it's time to go. Thank you for joining us. Luckily, we'll be back with our next episode soon, jam-packed with more incredible humans. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and sharing. To join the conversation, search The Podcast on LinkedIn. And to catch up on past episodes and more info, please visit www.thepodcast.com.